The Catholic Channel Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love with your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Executive Director of Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world, and we kind of just say just love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. So we're here in towards the end of November. Thanksgiving is coming up, and we finished the elections. And so there is a lot going on in the world. And so this week, our first guest in just a few moments is going to be Lucas Swenpool, who is the Vice President of Social Policy for Catholic Charities USA. And we'll do a little bit of recapping of the election and what it means for the perspective of social policy from our Catholic perspective. So I'm delighted that Lucas is going to be with us. And then kind of a little bit later on in the show, we're going to speak with somebody who is the pastor of a parish in the Archdiocese of New York, Father John Higgins. And we're going to speak to him about a particular program that he has in this parish. And we're going to speak about the reality of how a parish reaches out and is charitable. It's very appropriate for Thanksgiving because people do reach out and they do try to help their neighbors in need. And Father Higgins has been doing this for a while in his parish. There's a program there which they call Matthew 25 in kind of recognition of that part of Matthew's gospel in which he talks about helping those who are in need as very, very central to the Christian message, especially if you want to get into heaven, because that's the last judgment scene. So we're going to do that a little bit later on in the show. And then, you know, we got a bunch of news notes that we're going to do. We're going to look at a little bit of a trip that I just took to Puerto Rico, which was a service project that was part of that trip with the National Supermarket Association at one of the Catholic Charities New York Foundling Head Start programs in Puerto Rico. So we got a lot today. Fanny, what's on your mind today? Anything?
Well, it's getting colder.
It is getting colder. Yeah. Well, that, you know, that's what they, you know what they call that, Fanny? They call that seasons.
Winter.
Yeah, they call it seasons. No, we got another month before.
I know.
Before have you been you getting ready for Thanksgiving yet?
I am. Yeah, so Thanksgiving is usually at my mom's house, but I'm having a Friendsgiving at my apartment this year with all of my friends.
On Thanksgiving Day?
Or? No, that's Saturday.
Okay, that's Saturday. Oh, I like that. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
You cook it?
We are ordering from an Italian place by me, which I love that place. It's called Maggiano's.
Okay.
It's a lot of us, so they felt bad. And they said that we should order, so that's what we're doing.
Have any, no turkey?
No turkey. Just a lot of Italian food.
Because
everyone is having turkey on their own.
Okay. That's a good point.
Yeah.
So what I now have to do is I have to beg from my cousin for the turkey caucus.
Okay.
The turkey caucus because I want to make turkey soup.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, I got it last year, but I wasn't promised it this year. So I'm going to put in my request.
My request.
So,
yeah.
anyway, so let's talk about the election. Lucas Swenpool is the Vice President of Social Policy at Catholic Charities USA in Alexandria, Virginia, at least for the time being, because I got to ask Lucas, maybe with Amazon going to that area, maybe he's going to go work for Amazon.
Maybe.
So we'll have to Lucas about that. And so we're going to speak with him. So Lucas Swenpool, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. So you're going to work for Amazon?
No, I think we're just all wondering what it means if we have to no longer call it Crystal City anymore.
Well, I just think you're going to call it Amazing City or Amazon City,
yeah,
something like that. So actually, you know, next week, Lucas, we're going to speak, we're going to devote a segment of our Just Love show to talking about Amazon, and we're going to talk about some of the social policy implications about when municipalities and which states give tax incentives to encourage jobs, and do they give too many, and how do we figure out whether it's the right level or not? I mean, the only thing that I want to say at this moment, I just hope that we have common use of Jeff Bezos's helipad. That's the only thing I want in New York, because he got a helipad as part of the deal. And I don't know. I'm not sure about that, but he better share that.
And I'm hoping it just improves our metro here in D.C. also.
Well, okay. That's good, too. So anyway, so Lucas, we had an election.
Indeed, we did.
All right. So you give our listeners a little bit your perspective on what happened in the election.
Well, I think in many ways we saw a little bit of what we expected, and that was we figured that Democrats would do better during this cycle. Usually the party not in power during an off year after a new election of a president usually does better, and we did see that particularly in the House with the Democrats picking up a number of seats, picking up over 30. There's still, of course, about 10 races still undecided, but it did show that historical trend continued to exist of Democrats picking up seats the off party picking up seats in a non-presidential year.
So Lucas, I don't remember this. You should know this. So if we go back to last, like before the election, how big a majority did the Republicans have in the House?
So they had about the Democrats needed to pick up 30 seats in order to take control of the House of Representatives.
I thought they had to pick up. I thought they had to pick 23.
23. Sorry, they picked up 30 as of so far. So currently, we're looking at the breakdown. It's 225 Democrats to 200 Republicans. Obviously, 218 is the number that either party needs to get over to.
No, but what was it the last Congress for the Republicans? How many seats did they have?
It was a 23-seat majority.
What was the number?
Let me pull up the number quick. I don't have it off the top of my head.
Okay. So, in other words, my question I want to get at: Did the last time the Republicans have more of a majority than the Democrats have this time, or the other way around?
The Democrats have a slightly larger number right now,
but it's more or less in the same ballpark.
We're all still in the same ballpark.
Okay.
And usually, we're within about 7 seats from each given cycle, so it's not a dramatic change from previous election cycles.
Okay, so that's what they're. So anyway, is it a little bit uncommon that the Senate goes the opposite way in the midterm elections?
Usually they trend together. I mean, one of the things that's unique about the Senate, obviously, is every 6 years,
right,
is the election cycle. And this particular cycle, given the seats that were up, many of them were in states that the president did very well in last cycle, and the Democrats were trying to hold those seats. So that was a bit unique in the sense of actually Republicans expanding their majority slightly, looks like at least a fair amount in the Senate. So.
Okay, so okay, we got that, and again, I think the Democrats picked up 6 or 7, something like that, in terms of the governorships, right?
That's correct.
So it was kind of a split election in some ways. Maybe, you know, if you had just the numbers, the Democrats probably did better than the Republicans, and which is common in a midterm election cycle. So it was, you know, there wasn't anything too extraordinary about it, but at the same time, something that was terribly important happened, right?
That's correct. I think one of the big pieces, obviously, whenever you go from a time when you have single party control of all chambers of the Congress and the presidency to now having kind of split control of it, it does change the dynamics here in Washington as to what is possible to get done, but also how the relationships between the parties will kind of exist moving forward.
So again, I think for our listeners throughout the country, Lucas, and you know this very well, but sometimes we forget it, that the Catholic Church is very, very much concerned about policies because we think they affect the human person. And so we really care what our government does. At the same time, that doesn't mean that we want to be or should be partisan. And sometimes that may not be the easiest distinction for people to get because they say, oh, you play in politics. Well, we're playing in the public square and we're voicing our opinion about what we think will be good for the human person, good for community. And sometimes that makes us take positions which are not popular. And at the same time, it sometimes makes us take positions which align with the policy positions of one or the other of the party. So, but that doesn't make us partisan. Same time, some members of the church and even some members of the hierarchy at times speak in a way which certainly gives the impression of being partisan. So having said that as a little bit of a disclaimer, given our values, given what's important to us, Lucas, what are we going to do with the new Congress and what do you see as our agenda in moving forward?
I think one of the big pieces that we can particularly play moving forward this Congress is exactly what you just mentioned on that. You know, we often fall on both sides of the political aisle. And I think kind of reminding both voters and the American people, but also the members of Congress, that it isn't about parties first, but should be looking at their faith. So it isn't whether you're Democrat or Republican, it's whether you're Catholic. So I think for us as the Catholic community, we'll be looking at a number of the things that show that human dignity can be seen consistently throughout. So making sure the voice of the poor are uplifted, making sure that we have Catholic social services are able to do what they can do in their communities in accordance with their mission and their faith. But also making sure that we're actually moving the ball forward on important things like immigration, comprehensive immigration reform. I think those are a couple of things that we'll see coming into the new Congress. I do think actually in the lame duck period, so the period between now and the end of the year, a number of these issues will be coming front and center again. So I think in many ways we wait till next Congress, but really it begins today.
So let me just do a little technical stuff for our listeners. Even though at the moment and for the next couple of months, we'll have the same party in control of all three parts of the government, the two legislative houses and the White House, the same party, the Republicans, do not have a two-thirds majority in the Congress. And so they don't have a supermajority. So there's still a lot of legislation that does need to pass the Senate, which probably is going to have a hard time passing because of that in the lame duck session. Am I correct in that analysis?
Yeah, and that's correct. Even going into next year, I think we often forget, we think that a majority is all they need in both the House and Senate. But the reality is, particularly in the Senate, usually you need 60 votes on any legislation to move it forward in order to get over the filibuster. So that means on any piece of legislation, both in the last Congress and looking forward, you do need some bipartisanship on those bills in order to move them forward.
So, all right. So we're speaking with Lewis Swanpole, who is the Vice President of Social Policy for Catholic Charities USA. And I might add, because I've worked with Lucas, incredibly competent and incredibly dedicated and just does a great job on behalf of the Catholic Church, Catholic Charities in Washington. So I was delighted that he is doing that. And also, I'm delighted that you've taken the time to be with us. So realistically, okay, where are we going to be able to make some progress in some legislative initiatives, you think, in the new Congress? What are you looking to as where people maybe can cross their fingers, say a lot of prayers, and hope that we can get some things forward?
I think one piece we can look at right at the bat, and actually it may be something, depending on how a later press conference goes today, about criminal justice reform is one piece where I think there is a lot of bipartisan support. It has increasingly grown in its bipartisan support, and it's something that the president himself has taken a greater interest in. So I think that is one piece that I think is important for addressing how we sentence people in a more just way, how our prisons can be more just, but also how do we make sure we have programs that help these returning citizens come back to their communities. I think that's one area where there's a growing bipartisan consensus. I think the other piece, obviously, has been some of the work related to the opioid crisis. Obviously, a lot of that they've passed a number of bills and provided new funding over the last couple weeks, but as that continues to be a crisis that impacts both rural and urban centers, it is a place that really drives people to come together to look for solutions. And then finally, I think the issue of immigration reform will continue to be a difficult conversation, but one I hope that because both sides have an interest in having that difficult conversation, we can come to a productive solution on it.
So speak to that a little bit, because it certainly seems to me that if you could put everybody in a room, and if you could have a conversation about immigration, and then if you took a secret ballot, and then you burnt the ballots, and you made sure the Russians weren't hacking the room, we could probably get a decent piece of legislation passed on immigration. But given the fact that none of what I said is the conditions for getting that are real, why do you think we're going to get some?
I think because oftentimes what you see in these conversations when there's a difficult issue, one party might want, in this case, the Democrats often want a more expansive solutions for migrants, whereas the other, the president's really been pushing for border enforcement. And because things in the Senate require bipartisan solutions, if the president insists on having border solutions, it gives a lot of power for Democrats to also ask for fixes for immigration. So I think it depends on how badly each party wants to have their portion of the immigration piece resolved, and they finally have to sit down and resolve and understand in order to do their piece, they're going to need to play along with each other. And I think particularly as we come up to the December 7th deadline, this conversation will be coming to the forefront. It's been in the media. It's been continually discussed. And the December 7th, which is the time when Congress must pass a new government funding bill, those always become the opportunity and moment where both parties can come together on some of these politically difficult questions.
So, I mean, are you looking in this lame duck session? You think there might be something on immigration?
I believe it'll be a big portion of what's discussed, yes.
No. But do you think it'll get passed?
We don't know yet, frankly. Right. I think it is a piece that's possible. It's going to come down to how much the president wants the funding for the wall, for example, in the final appropriations bill. And if he insists that it is there, that means the government will likely shut down until that money is put into the program. So.
Yeah, and again, I think, like we said, we're concerned about good government. We're concerned about good policy. I don't mind saying myself is that right now we have dysfunctional government. We have dysfunctional government, and I think a lot of the blame goes to the president. I think some of the blame goes to Congress, and quite frankly, I think a lot of the blame goes to all of us, because even though there was a very heavy turnout in this midterm election compared with some others, we still do not have the amount of civic participation that would make things more accountable. So I think all of us have something to be held a little bit responsible for in terms of the paralysis that we have here. And so that's not a good situation that we have. So Lucas, let me ask you a question about do you think in terms of the how much, I mean, when I listen to the debate, and you're closer to it than I am, when I listen to the debate, much more of the conversation and much more of the commentary, which depresses me, is on, well, how is this going to play with our constituents, even on immigration? Well, can the Republicans be so negative? Does it mean they're not going to get any Latino votes? If the Democrats do this, will it hurt their women base? All of that. You've been around this for a while. How much more is the conversation now about how it's going to play out in votes as opposed to how it's going to play out for the good of the country?
That is a big driver. I think both parties obviously look to who their kind of constituents are or their key constituents, and unfortunately that does mean that it's harder for them to come together. You noted that it's hard for them to come together. These kind of, we have paralysis, but I think what happens then is we have government by crisis, meaning we don't really come together. They're not forced to get over these holdups until there's a crisis moment, and that's why things like the year-end budget agreement, natural disasters, those types of moments throughout the congressional year, unfortunately, become the times when people are forced to come together to get over those concerns about, I'm going to upset a key constituency group, is to wait for when a crisis comes, and now they're forced to come together. Sadly, I don't think the American people appreciate that. I think we all would rather see them come together every single day rather than waiting until a crisis. But that increasingly is becoming what is happening in order to get them to pass important legislation.
Well, and I would say, I would add another point of view from the point of view of kind of civics. If I were kind of doing my little analysis of what's going on in the federal government, is we basically have only two branches of government anymore. And basically the paralysis in Congress has created a stalemate, which means that we have the executive branch issuing inappropriate executive orders, which then the judicial branch periodically holds them accountable 8 or 9 months later while they're wreaking havoc. And so it's basically a fight between the executive and the judiciary, and Congress is, and the legislative branch is just abdicating its role. But that's kind of my cynical New York perspective on what's going on in the fair city of Washington.
No, I think that assessment is one that most of us share. I think the increasing use by both parties of executive orders in order to kind of circumvent the process is a concern for, should be a concern for any American. It is, it circumvents the legislative process. It does lead to really dramatic changes overnight to big programs without the kind of the buy-in that you get with the legislative process.
Yeah, and it's, and well, we seem to be stuck with it for the moment. And again, from the point of view of good government and making our government function better, is there much advocacy going on, whether it be at Catholic Charities USA or the Conference of Bishops or other groups with whom you relate, about two issues which it seems to me are two of the issues that have done so much to create this paralysis? And one of them is the issue of gerrymandering, and the second issue is the issue of money in campaigns. Is there anything going on that might give us some hope of movement in those areas?
I think on the gerrymandering case, we did see some progress in the states this last election cycle, with a number of states moving from the legislature deciding the new districts. Colorado, for example, voted to have a nonpartisan body redraw the lines for the state. I think there were a couple other state initiatives where this has been going on. Obviously, gerrymandering is a state-level issue.
Right.
And so at that level, you did see a little bit of progress this year, I think, for good governance. Personally, I think that was hopeful, that now they're going to actually have nonpartisan rather than, you know, a winner-take-all kind of system of drawing the election lines. On the issue of campaign funding, it hasn't been an issue we have taken up here in the last few years, but I do know it's something that the Bishops' Conference has weighed in and local groups have weighed in on, the role of money in our elections and making sure that everybody's voice counts. So when they put out the Faithful Citizenship document, for example, some of those types of issues are in that.
And again, we have a little bit of a problem, because whatever you're going to devise to deal with that, we do have the Supreme Court decision, which kind of opened a lot of floodgates for campaign stuff. So whatever we crafted has to be cognizant of that in some way, too.
That's correct. The changing landscape with the Citizens United case fundamentally changed how what is even possible to be done in the advocacy space now that it's being considered a constitutional question.
And the other issue, Lucas, which really concerns me, the media plays into all of this. And I'm not necessarily saying there's another way out, but it was very hard in the past election cycle to get past the third paragraph of an article on it, whatever election was coming up, without saying, well, this person seems to be favored because he or she has raised three times the amount of money that his or her opponent has raised. And it seems to me that they almost the lead is whoever can raise the most money is going to win the election. It was just, to me, and far before any policy issues got discussed, they discussed the money issue.
Yeah, and we see that kind of increasingly with the media, particularly television media, the issue of politics as sport rather than kind of politics as justice, as we would understand it, that it's the talking heads kind of one side against the other, kind of playing the game of sports using politics. And unfortunately, that means policy isn't discussed as much as it should be. And I think that's one of the areas we've have an increasing concern, because how do we have an informed electorate when it's more about the conversation of who has more money or who's up and who's down on a particular moment rather than the policies that we're actually looking to push forward?
So one kind of final question, then I'll let you go, is how's your reading of the possibility of getting things done? And you talked about, and I have a tendency to agree with you, that the issues you brought up, criminal justice reform, opioid, are things that there might be enough common ground. I also think there's probably some common ground on some veterans issues where you might be able to get some movement there. Immigration, I'm a little bit less sanguine. And what I'm really not sanguine about is that if we do get a compromise, it will not be a good compromise. It will simply be one extreme gets one piece of the pie and the other extreme gets another piece of the pie. But having said all that, the question I ask is, given some of the new kind of demographics of people in Congress, and it's not only this year, and it goes back to the gerrymandering issue, are we in fact getting a lot more kind of extremes, or people more than one standard deviation away from the center in both the Republican Party and the Democrat Party that makes compromise even more difficult?
100%. I think a lot of different survey data has shown not only this Congress but previous Congresses the increasing partisanship of both parties. Where there used to be a large number of kind of compromise members who were able and willing to work across the aisle, increasingly both parties have moved further to kind of the relative extremes, which makes, of course, our job that much harder in trying to bring them together, but it also makes it that much harder for them to actually come together. So it is a big concern for us, and I think for any voting American it should be a concern. Because as that becomes harder to do, it does paralyze our government. It does mean it becomes a winner-takes-all kind of legislation rather than let's see compromise and dialogue on issues.
Lucas Wanpohl, the Vice President for Social Policy at Catholic Charities USA, thanks for spending your time with us, and thanks for the work that you do in trying to kind of work for policies that are more just and that they do try to force to the common good. And so a happy Thanksgiving to you, and thanks for being with us on Just Love.
Happy Thanksgiving. God bless.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Why don't we take a break, and we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about some things that are in the news, Fanny, and then we'll talk with our other guest about some of the good things that are going on in the parishes in the try to put forth the social mission of the church. So just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And the world will be more just and will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Now, let's get back to Just Love and your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Come gather round, people. Welcome back to Just Love. Thanks for being with us. Our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. You know, we just spoke with Lucas Wanpohl about one of the areas where he thinks there might be some hope for good legislation in Washington, and that's the area of criminal justice reform. But before all of that stuff happens, there sometimes are things that occur that are kind of intriguing of what's going on in prisons and with inmates. So we got World Youth Day coming up, Fanny, right?
Yep, in January.
So tell us what's going on with the inmates at La Jolla Prison about World Youth Day.
Sure. So the inmates from La Jolla and Nueva Jolla prisons have begun the construction of 250 confessionals to be used in the Sacrament of Reconciliation at World Youth Day in Panama in January. So the confessionals will be set up in Omar Recreation Park in Panama City, which will be then called Forgiveness Park during the youth event. In total, 35 inmates are working from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. daily, sanding, painting, and assembling the crosses and wooden confessionals. In an interview conducted by World Youth Day organizers, the prisoners said that the project is not just simple cabinetry work, but allows them to contribute to a project aimed to young people who will be able to take a different path than they did. So the project coordinator for the prison system, Alma De Leon, explains that the work is being done with the support of the instructor for the National Institute of Professional Formation and Training for Human Development of Panama, and it is a way to demonstrate the capabilities of people in prison.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
It is very neat.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a big feature of World Youth Day, which I've attended a number of them, is the opportunity for young people to experience Jesus, and as part of that experience, to realize that there are things in their lives that need to change, things they've done that are wrong. And it becomes an opportunity for people to go to the Sacrament of Reconciliation. And so that's a neat neat thing. And that I think to use inmates to do it, it's kind of really an important feature.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's very, very interesting. I don't know if you remember, but something similar happened in when Pope Francis came to New York. And we have, Catholic Charities has a school, a campus, a residence in which there are young people on that campus. And we also work with a bunch of day laborers. And those groups, they put together the chair and they put together the altar, they put together the podium for the Pope to use when he came to visit in New York. And actually, in that Catholic Charities program, Lincoln Hall, that is a program as kind of an alternative for incarceration, tries to keep young men out of jail. And so that was a wonderful use. They loved doing it. They're working in creating the altar and building it. So it was a nice opportunity. So that's a great story that is that's there. So we still got the awful wildfires in California. So
yeah.
Catholic Charities doing anything with regard to them?
Yeah, so there's a lot going on there. So far there's been 48 deaths and just many thousands and thousands of acres just burnt in California, the region of Paradise, California. But the Catholic Charities of Northern Nevada is launching this campaign for disaster relief to just help their brothers and sisters next door. And they're asking for warm clothes, blankets, shoes, paper products like toilet paper, forks, spoons, so anything like that. So if you're in that area, you can stop by the Catholic Charities of Northern Nevada to drop that off. If you're not in that area, however, CCUSA, Catholic Charities USA, is taking donations, and 100% of the funds raised through those donations will be then sent to help those in need in California. You can go to ccusa.gives/wildfire or text wildfires with a S at the end to 71777 with your donation.
Okay, thank you. And, you know, as always, Catholic Charities USA nationally and in collaboration and often most times through the local Catholic Charities agency in a particular area is on the scene first. And one of the effectivenesses of Catholic Charities USA is that we're, or Catholic Charities throughout the United States, with the support of our national Catholic Charities USA, is that we're in the community. So when a disaster and emergency hits, we don't kind of parachute in. We kind of just expand what we're doing locally in order to meet those needs that are there. So I'm going to use, Fanny, a point of personal privilege, because the first parish that I was in was St. Elizabeth's Parish in a part of New York City in Washington Heights.
Of Hungary?
Yep.
Not Anzian, yeah.
And so we have her feast day on November 17th, right?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about St. Elizabeth of Hungary, which relates to our show, Just Love. So tell us a little bit about her.
Sure. One of the things that I found out about her was that she was very young.
Okay.
So she was married to Ludwig the IV of Thuringia. I probably said that wrong.
Okay.
But he was a German nobleman. She was about 15 years old when
wow.
she was married off to him, but she was very in love with him. So,
okay.
So she
That's
fell in
good.
Love with him. Yes.
It's good that people get married when they're in love.
Yes.
Good
yes,
thing.
It is.
Okay.
So they had three kids.
How old was he? Do you know?
I'm not sure how old he was. I know that when she was born, maybe at age 4, her father, kind of married her, like, said that, okay, this is the man you're supposed to be married.
Okay.
So sent her off to school. And then when she came back at age about 14, 15, she was married off to him.
Okay.
So this was a lifelong thing for her. She already knew.
Okay.
But they had three kids together. And because he was sort of this rich person in government, knew a lot of people, it was rare back then for people like that to help the poor. But Elizabeth, said, you know what, I'm going to do it. So she started to help him, and he was very, she started to help the poor, but he was very supportive of her. And she began to lead a very simple life, practicing penance, devoted herself to works of charity. She used her royal position to advance her mission for charity. And in 1223, Franciscan friars arrived at her town and taught the 16-year-old back then, Elizabeth, about St. Francis of Assisi and his ideals on poverty, etc. So she then forth decided to live her life mirroring St. Francis of Assisi and his charitable works and poverty. So she wore simple clothing, set aside time every day to take bread to hundreds of poor people in her land. And her and her husband were both very, politically powerful and lived in with a very remarkable generosity towards the poor. And I think that's very important. She was canonized in 1235, May 27th. And her feast day is celebrated November 17th.
That's a great story. Now, there's a little bit of a dark side to that story, too.
Mm-hmm.
And the dark side to the story is that even doing something as good or nice as and gospel-like as helping people in need and people who are poor, it doesn't always sit well with people. And so after her husband died, she kind of continued to do that. But her relatives didn't really think it was such a neat thing mm-hmm. for her to be helping the poor. And they kind of ostracized her a little bit, and they tried to prevent her from helping the poor.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a reminder. And she, tried to continue to do it despite all of the opposition from her relatives, her in-laws. And I think, that's a little bit of a reminder to us, I think, today when when we read the gospel, we say, of course you should help the poor. But it doesn't always go down well in society because it sometimes cuts against the grain. Sometimes people say, well, who do you think you are? You think you're so good and special and you're helping people. You think you're better than me. Well, that's one. But sometimes when you try to do things to help people and you have programs and services, well, sometimes people in the neighborhood say, oh, wait a minute, I don't want this in my neighborhood because, we don't want all these poor people hanging around here. And even in the gospel, remember the gospel? Remember when this guy was crying out at the side of the road to Jesus. What did the disciples say?
So he was blind, the blind man. Yeah. They basically told him that he was no one, like to just keep going, didn't
they? Shut up.
Yeah. The blind man.
Yeah.
Yes.
They said, be quiet. And Jesus said, no, bring him here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think Elizabeth of Hungary, whose feast is November 17th, is a reminder of, A, the call of the gospel to reach out to people in need, but also a reminder that it doesn't always go down smoothly, because sometimes people, you know, for whatever reason, want to do things a little bit different. So anyway, with that, why don't we take a break? And when we come back, we'll speak about Matthew 25 with Father John Higgins, and we'll speak about his outreach. So I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Just do it. Just love. Just check out Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, who's here right now. Take it away, Monsignor.
Welcome back to Just Love. And we welcome back with Mariah Carey's Emotions. And the reason we're doing that is because we just ran into Mariah Carey. Literally, as we were coming into our studio here, she was coming out. Now, we have an incredibly talented group of people. Tom Dobbins is here, Fanny's here, Jake's here, Scott's here, talented. Well, you multiply that by 10, and we had to go through the 50 people who were part of Mariah Carey's entourage that was here. I think they scored more than us. I mean, if we were the defensive team, they ran us over on the way out. But anyway, so we figured we'd play a little bit of her songs. You know, and we're talking about good stuff, and you know, I like her music and everything. But for a number of years, Mariah Carey was very, very supportive of the Fresh Air Funds and helped kids to go away to camps and things like that. And so, you know, whatever the page sixes write about all the stars and things, and I let's assume they're true if they're negative, if they're positive, whatever. But I do think it's good that, you know, that are some of our celebrities, and probably a fair number of them, do certain charitable and service things, and that's good. I mean, I do want to remind all of our celebrities about the gospel passage about the widow's mite, so that when the celebrities kind of do their little showy things, which is probably a pittance of what they're earning, and other people who don't get much notoriety on being a little bit more sacrificed, we should be grateful. But we should, like, say, hey, there's a little bit more to the sacrifice than just kind of giving from your excess whenever you want to do it. But anyway, be that as it may. So let's now go to somebody who for years has been giving tremendously in his ministry, Father John Higgins, who is now the pastor of Holy Cross Church in one of the boroughs of New York City, the Bronx. And Father John Higgins, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Monsignor Sullivan, here on Just Love.
Great. So tell us a little bit about the Matthew 25 ministry. And I know you engaged in this ministry when you were in the suburbs up in Westchester. Now you're doing it in Holy Cross Parish. So tell us what the Matthew 25 ministry is about.
Sure. Matthew 25 was founded in response to needs that were concrete and real, in the vast majority of physical needs that in its first iteration up there in Peekskill, New York, was founded by Father Vincent Druding, who was a parochial vicar there. He gathered some parishioners around him, and then they both went out and found the need, and as you know, Monsignor, in any Catholic parish, the need finds its way to you. And so the purpose of it is to recognize Christ in the least, the last, and the lost, and to bring material relief to them. As the Lord Jesus said in Matthew 25, verse 40, he said, "Whatsoever you do to the least of my brothers and sisters, you do to me." So we try to serve Christ in the neediest.
Well, that is just a wonderful, wonderful ministry. And one of the reasons, Father Higgins, I asked you to be on is because we did something as a pilot project this year in the Archdiocese of New York, in which we made a little bit of change in the Catholic Campaign for Human Development collection, and we transformed it into the Catholic Charities Campaign for Justice and Charity. And one of the reasons we did that is because we wanted to take the spirit of the Catholic Campaign for Human Development and build on it to foster those works of social ministry, charity and justice, in parishes, in addition to community-based organizations. And so we were just delighted when the Matthew 25 ministry kind of applied for a grant from that collection, and that we were able to provide that. So that I'm delighted that kind of we're talking to you about this transition and about the wonderful work that you're doing. Can you share with our listeners any particular story of a particular family, a particular need or individual that moved you and Matthew 25 responded to?
Sure, Monsignor. The one word just came to our attention just a couple days ago is something we wanted to help immediately. You know, our Matthew 25 people in some sense consider themselves always on duty. There's maybe 15 to 20 people that come to our monthly meetings, but the monthly meetings is just administrative. The real work is done in between the meetings when they go out. And one of our members came across a family, a woman who was illegally selling things on the street. She had recently come from another country and was not aware of any of the kind of regulations that exist in New York City for what you could sell on the street or not. It's very customary in her native El Salvador. And you know, someone had called the police and wanted to get her out from selling in front of a school where her recently come across the border, kids were attending when she was doing anything to get food, to bet money to buy food for them and clothing. And when she was being harassed in this sense, not by the police, but by the others that were there, the Matthew 25 says, member said, "I'll take charge of you." And she kind of accompanied her for the next 24 hours and to see the incredible situation she was living in. Her kids were just released from 6 months of detention. They had come as unaccompanied minors, age 11 and 13, across the border, were released to a relative's care, and now with her. She also has a two-year-old. She is someone through the kindness of their heart had given a part of a rented room to her to stay in, and the children were sleeping on the floor. So when Matthew 25, a member, was there immediately, you know, thank you so much to the grant for the Catholic Campaign for Charity and Justice that we received some months back. We're able to, first of all, get them stabilized with food. We got them some beds and some blankets. But it didn't just stop there with material relief, because they were lost. They had no one. Brought them to church, and we brought them to our Matthew 25 group, and they were weeping with joy for the fact that someone was taking them by the hand. And we always quote Pope Francis, who used that word accompanying. So that's what they're doing. It's ongoing as we look for better housing and to meet their other legal and material needs. But that's just the case. When we heard her story, it just brought us all to tears, and it moved us very much.
Oh, that is just such a really, really wonderful story. And, you know, sometimes it's very complicated when we have to help people because of the multiple problems. But sometimes you just got to begin, and you begin to help them, and then you try to figure out the other parts of it, and then you try to keep going forward. And, you know, it's interesting, Father Higgins, this morning before doing this show, I met with about 15 brand new workers at Catholic Charities. And I said, you know, we use the word case management for the way we try to assess what's going on with somebody, come up with a plan to help them, and then advocate for them getting that help. But I said, you know, and that's really critically important, but let's just remember, we're not dealing with cases. We're dealing with individuals.
Okay.
We're dealing with people. And it seems to me what you just described is a wonderful example of dealing with people. You know, it reminds me a little bit of, and unfortunately, we haven't had a robust history of the St. Vincent de Paul Society in the Archdiocese of New York. In other parts of the country, it really is thriving. But here, it just didn't take off too much. But the approach you describe in Matthew 25 has a lot of similarities with the St. Vincent de Paul Society approach, I would think, don't you?
Very much so, Monsignor. Yes, in fact, we take St. Vincent de Paul as one of our patrons. It's partly in my blood because my parents met through the St. Vincent de Paul Society. It tries to be very, very concrete in terms of not dealing with cases, but dealing with people. And so, in fact, at each of our monthly meetings, we quote one line that my father used to quote to me from St. Vincent de Paul, who said, "We must be so kind to the poor that they will forgive us for the bread that we give them."
Yep.
It's a counterintuitive statement, but it's something that informs our way of dealing with people.
And I think they quoted it, maybe a little bit out of context, but somebody quotes a similar thing to that, saying that it's only because of your love that you'll get forgiven when you help somebody. So that is a great way. And, you know, I think as we approach Thanksgiving and a lot of people will do a lot of good, generous service, I think it's critically important to remember that we had better love, we better be kind, we better be compassionate when we're giving out a Thanksgiving meal, when we're serving somebody. So, Father Higgins, a happy Thanksgiving to you. Thank you for Matthew 25, and the best to you. Thanks for being with us on Just Love.
God bless you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good. So, Fanny, you ever buy anything on Amazon?
I buy everything on Amazon. Literally everything.
So we got a new neighbor?
We do.
Yeah, so you can't go work for them, though.
Okay, I promise I won't.
Okay, good. We're getting a views thing, and as I was talking to Lucas, they're in one part of New York City. They're also right outside of Washington, D.C.
Right.
So we got two of these big guys. They're promising 25,000 jobs,
mm-hmm.
and they got a lot of tax breaks. You know, they got a lot of tax breaks in order to be there, and the government's doing a lot to get them there. And next week, we're going to have somebody on the show, and we're going to discuss that, because you got to trade off to see, well, okay, would they have come without the tax breaks, or, you know, what are we getting back as a result of it? And so it's a really important conversation to have, because a tax break means that taxpayers will wind up paying more for the services. And so we're going to talk about that. The only thing I really care about is they deliver it to my house and don't leave it someplace where I can't get
it. Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for being with us, and happy Thanksgiving. And please be good with your families, be kind to your families, and let them be kind to you. Just love God, neighbor, self. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. This is the Catholic Channel. Just love, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.